This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing the oral history interview with Colonel Ann Smith. Today's date is the 31st of March, 2005. I'm on the campus of Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas, and I'm speaking to Ann by telephone. She's at her home in Alabama. And Ann, you and I have been speaking, but I want to say again good morning and thank you for resuming our interviews. Let's start, if you don't mind, by exploring how it was that you were assigned to the U.S. Army Command and Staff, Command and General Staff College in 1968.
I was working for the director of the Women's Army Corps and was selected. It was, for lack of a better word, competitive because there was only a limited number of women who was selected to go into the class, and I was one of the ones who was selected, fortunate enough to be selected, to attend the nine-month course at Leavenworth. At one time, they only let women go to the short course, which was 6 months, and was mostly for the reserve components. Mm-hmm. But a couple of years, I think, before I went, they opened the long course, as they call it, to women, and I was one of four or five selected to go that year.
Did you sort of make friends with the other women who
I'd known
were in
them
your
all.
Year? You had already known them all.
Oh, yeah. Small world.
Can you recall for us their names? It would be interesting to have that kind of class composite.
Joan Alice Bazell, J-O-A-N-A-L-Y-S. B-I-Z-E-L-L-E. Mm-hmm. Colleen Brooks. I'm drawing a blank on the other.
That's all right. You did great. And did they have specializations within the Women's Army Corps, or had they had specializations that were different from yours?
Not in general, no, because we, early on we all did the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We trained trainees. We went recruiting. We eventually got a staff type assignment, and all of us had staff assignments because, you know, that was part of the name of the college, Command and General Staff.
Right.
And so.
Well, Ann, can you tell me a little bit about the curriculum? What was the intention behind the courses that were taught, and what in fact did you study?
Well, they were to prepare the senior captains, majors, and lieutenant colonels, and all the women who went were lieutenant colonels,
mm-hmm.
for higher staff positions and command. They would be going into battalion commands and higher the men, and to the DA staff and general staffs on larger commands like divisions and brigades. And it was very heavily weighted, of course, toward the combat arms functions and the support of the combat arms. If we did a big class project, it might be set in a brigade, but it might concentrate on the logistics part,
mm-hmm.
or perhaps on the personnel management aspect. But command was the heart of the course, and it was during Vietnam.
Yes.
So of course, it was so much related to Vietnam, and all the tactics I felt, since I know so much about tactics, all of the tactics were based on Vietnam. The interesting, to me, an interesting story.
Mm-hmm.
I had gone to nuclear weapons employment school at Fort Benning.
Right.
Before I was assigned at the WAC school at McClellan. So I was qualified to be a nuclear weapons specialist, employment specialist.
Mm-hmm.
At one of the few in my particular section, of course, because not everybody went. So one day, one of the teachers was an instructor, young major, stood up and said, "Major Smith, as an outsider," I hadn't been promoted then,
okay.
"as an outsider, how do you feel about the future of nuclear war? And the, most of the men knew. I was the only woman in this group. They knew my background, and I stood up and took off on him because I said, we are using the most impractical version of nuclear war. I said, you'd think they were in a spray tank on a cargo plane, and you spray the world, and then you're still 90% effective in your mission. He never asked me another thing.
Now, you were sort of, as it were, armed and ready for that.
I wasn't expecting it, of mm-hmm. course, but I had the background to to make a comment, and he didn't know it.
What was his intention there? Was he kind of trying to lure you into a trap? Or what do you think was going on?
Well, in that situation, we were such a rare breed that they frequently would do something like that. Mm-hmm. And maybe to get a different view, maybe to be funny, but they always, we usually had a chaplain in each section and maybe a woman, but they always said, excuse me, chaplain, excuse me, Major Smith. And one day I said, if you have to excuse yourself for saying it, you shouldn't be saying it. And the chaplains didn't like being singled out either.
Mm-hmm. That was interesting. Did that kind of create a sort of harmony between the chaplain and maybe the female lieutenant colonel or the female major?
Oh, we all liked each other.
Uh-huh. I'll bet.
If you didn't like somebody, it was certainly other grounds. Mm-hmm. We were suffering together, all of us.
Now, by suffering, I wonder if you're being facetious or if you're talking about the workload.
Oh, just going through it.
Mm-hmm.
On one occasion, while I was a student, we changed groups. We were in three different groups during the course. About 50, 55, Norman Schwarzkopf sat right behind me.
No kidding.
Yeah. He was my section leader.
Uh-huh. So, now, if you gave him a phone call now, would he remember that?
I don't know. The last time I saw him was on Fort McNair or Fort Myer, and he was a major general, and he was mowing his yard, and I was driving by, and I stopped and spoke to him. I doubt that he would remember me now.
That's interesting. He was mowing his own yard. That's probably a good sign, I think. He's a heck of a guy. It's worth, since we're talking about him, to just ask you, can you give any kind of review of his performance in the Gulf War conflict? I mean, did you pay much attention to him?
Of course I paid attention because you know, I have known him, not intimately, certainly not in the biblical sense, but of course I was interested.
Sure.
And a great respect for him.
Mm-hmm.
And even when he was a lieutenant colonel, he was considered, in military parlance, a comer.
Really?
He was highly regarded. He had been in Vietnam. He'd commanded there.
Mm-hmm.
And people deferred to his judgment.
Now, at the time that he's sitting behind you in class, he had already commanded troops in Vietnam.
I'm certain he had.
I think so, too.
I've sort of lost track of the sequence of things, but he had been in Vietnam, and if he'd been in Vietnam as an infantryman, he had certainly commanded something.
Can you tell me much about the tactics that you did study? Was it air mobility and those kinds of things that defined the Vietnam conflict as different from previous American engagements?
Yes, it did, but it struck me at the time that all the tactics was Vietnam, And that was not all the world of the Army. You know, we were learning to be active in Vietnam, but look what's happened since.
Mm-hmm. Was there much attention being paid to, for example, a potential land war with Soviet tanks coming across Germany, or had that kind of thing had backed away into
some
the
of the
shadows?
Tactical program lessons and exercises, of course, involved that. In fact, one time I remembered in one of the class programs exercises, they had tanks coming across the Khyber Pass, and I thought that was highly impractical.
Yeah, that's not exactly tank territory up there.
And then another time, we had an exercise, and it was based on terrain. They needed to have a certain type of terrain, and they put it in the Gulf, and the terrain actually was Israel and Egypt,
mm-hmm.
and to get the water right. And all of us knew that at that time it was totally not going to happen. But some general came and saw it, and they had to change the whole exercise because he didn't approve of using that particular scenario with that land because it wasn't possible at that time.
It didn't add up.
To him.
Uh-huh.
We were smart enough to understand.
That's very, very interesting. You suggested just briefly that there wasn't a great deal of consideration of Middle Eastern problems. Is that does that sound right? Is that fair?
Let's see. What all had happened by then? I don't remember.
Okay.
I remember, though, and this is one of the interesting things, we had students from all over the place. I mean, we had Yugoslavians and Israelis and Egyptians and Africans, a lot of Vietnamese, of course, and Koreans, and they were scattered out among us. And they did have a plan that they did not put warring factions in the same room.
Is that right? I was going to ask you about the social atmosphere. That's an interesting insight.
The social atmosphere there was, when you were in school, it was very important. And I went to a party one night that the Allies were giving, and they had a good time. Now, you would not find the Pakistani ethnic doing anything with the Indians, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But each country did a presentation during the course of the training that was know your world, I think they called it. So if the Colombians would give a presentation, and one day India was doing its presentation, and my buddy from Pakistan was there checking out the enemy.
Is that right?
So,
well, that did it put the Americans who were attending the classes in kind of a dicey situation once in a while?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
They took the Allied students went on a lot of trips. And one time they were in Washington, D.C., and a couple of the South Americans who insisted we are American. You know, when we talk about Americans, we talk about us.
Sure.
And they said, we are Americans. So they were somewhere in Rock Creek Park or someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody decided to rob them. And they're standing there saying, we're not Americans. We're not Americans. One time, somebody was being critical of Venezuela for its oil policy, and the Venezuelan stood and said, we are not trying to escrew the Americans.
We're not trying to escrew them?
Escrew. Which has become a standard for me. I'm not trying to escrew.
Well, so you got a chuckle out of this as well as...
Oh, yeah.
As well as I'm sure you got some, you know, broader view of both the international situation and the work of command.
It was a very great learning experience because we were exposed to so many cultures.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
If we chose to be exposed.
Right. So you could kind of make it what you would as an individual. You could engage or just not.
Surely. Mm-hmm. When you're in a room with 55 people or so, and you're sitting next to one person, we were at big tables, two-person tables. Mm-hmm. And you were assigned the person with whom you sat.
Yeah, right.
So you could talk to people or not.
And I guess, Anne, that these interviews will display that you kind of wanted to get to know them or find out a little bit more rather than sit there and be quiet, I'm sure.
Oh, I enjoyed being invited to have dinner with the Danes or to play liar's dice with a Swiss officer who could not understand why we would lie. And I was trying to show him how to play. But you're lying. Yes, that's the object of this play.
About how big was the class?
1,100.
Really?
Something. It's one of the biggest classes they ever had. And it may have been not quite that many, but it was big.
And any guess as to the percentage of international folks who were enrolled? Was it 10% or?
If I had my yearbook, I could tell you.
Really?
Yeah.
But
because it was in the yearbook,
it's
sort of a breakdown
mm-hmm.
of how many countries and how many people.
Well, where is the yearbook?
In the other room.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I didn't know I might need it.
Well, we don't want to send you to the other room. Let's keep you right where you are. Were you promoted during that year?
Yes.
And how did that come through? How did you find out about it?
By happenstance.
Mm-hmm.
Promotions are held secret. You know, don't tell until the commander calls you in and tells you about that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this was at a time when promotions had just opened up. They were promoting. They had promoted 6 women from colonel to lieutenant, from lieutenant colonel to colonel, and it had just opened things. So there was a backlog of majors who had not been selected because they couldn't be. There's nothing wrong with them. They just couldn't be selected.
Because there was that numerical cap?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And had the cap been essentially removed?
What happened was during President Johnson's presidency, they didn't say you can have a general or generals. They just removed the grade restriction.
Okay.
Because the original grade restriction was there will be one colonel, and she will be the director of the Women's Army Corps.
Mm-hmm.
By taking that restriction out, it just opened everything. It did not say you will have a general, but it meant you could.
Okay.
So at one fell swoop, people were promoted. So there was this backlog of majors. The woman who was senior on that list had been a major for about 20 years, I think. And they started working through it. And so I had been not selected the year before.
Mm-hmm.
And this year I was selected. And I went and talked to somebody, and I knew who had been promoted that day. There were promotions every day coming out almost. And she knew that I was on the list, though she had not told me, and nobody was supposed to tell me, and she did.
She couldn't.
No, unwittingly, because I said something about the other person who's a friend of mine, but that's very convoluted. Anyway, I found out.
And how long had you been at the rank of major? How many years have you had in rank?
Let's see, I was promoted in 68, I think, major. 64.
Okay, so you'd only been a major 4 years.
Yeah, but I had already been considered once.
Mm-hmm.
I was promoted in 69.
In 69, okay. So 4.5 years or something in that, on that order.
Yeah.
Wow, that 20 years in rank at major, that's really,
yeah,
that's really something.
Oh, yeah, and they stayed.
Yeah.
And one of these women was, I remember, was a logistician. And people she had trained kept getting promoted, and she just was stuck. But it cleared out a list.
Absolutely. And as you say, there were many promotions in that period of time.
Yeah.
A lot of them.
I can't guess how many,
yeah,
but I'm glad I was one of them.
Now, as you came to the end of the nine-month course, did you know what your next assignment was going to be? How did you find out?
Well, the career management branch told me.
And did they do that when you had just a little time left at Fort Leavenworth, or was it arranged earlier? Do you remember?
I can't remember how long it was, but there was a six-month lag between the time my predecessor left and I went. So I stayed at Leavenworth as a, you know what a snowbird is?
I think that's someone who comes from up north, isn't it?
No.
Get away from them.
It's someone who goes to an Army school before it starts,
okay,
and maybe have to hang around for 3 months doing something. If you have to hang around after school, you're a blackbird.
Okay.
So I was a blackbird.
You were a blackbird.
Yeah, and at Leavenworth, I had to wait for a Vietnamese language class to start so I could go to it before
and
I went to Vietnam.
How long did that language
The class? Whole process was about 6 months.
Okay.
I went to Vietnam in January,
of
New Year's Day.
Of 1970?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Where did the Vietnamese language class that you attended
El
take
Paso.
Place?
El Paso.
And was it an Army class?
It was Defense Language Institute.
Mm-hmm. How long did that class go?
It was an introductory course, and it seems to me 6 weeks. I can't remember. They had various courses. They had long courses for people who were going to be linguists and that sort of thing. And then they had the course that taught you to say hello.
And that was yours?
That was it. Yeah, I was in a class full of young lieutenants who were going over to work with the Vietnamese. It was less than effective.
Really? Who was the instructor?
Vietnamese.
Was this someone who was not necessarily skilled at teaching, or was it the curriculum or the pace, or why didn't it work very well?
Because it is a difficult language. It's a tonal language. And if you get the wrong tone, you've said something entirely different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard to get.
Now, Anne, let me ask you about the reaction of the young lieutenants to having a lieutenant colonel in their class who's a female who's going to Vietnam.
It didn't bother them.
Didn't it at all?
Not that I was aware of.
Uh-huh. Did they make friends and kind of, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Make you part of the group, make you part of the crowd?
Yes.
Good. Do you remember any incidents during that language training time that are worth sharing?
Well, one of the instructors invited me to dinner one night, and I enjoyed that. It's the first time I ever had Nook Mom.
And then when
I went to Vietnam, her husband invited me to dinner in Vietnam.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. She liked me a lot.
Okay, uh-huh. So she had arranged that with him, I'm sure.
Yeah.
What did you know about the position that you were going to take up in Vietnam before you got there?
Well, having worked in the WAC director's office, I was aware of the advisors to the Vietnamese Women's Armed Forces Corps. And I didn't know a lot about it, but I knew the first advisor who went there. And in fact, I knew all of them one way or another. And I was replacing one of my best friends. And the reason I had to wait to go was because she extended. So,
And it would be helpful to the extent that you can, to tell us who those predecessors in that position had been, including, you mentioned the first one.
Kathleen Wilkes.
Any idea what year she went over and or when that would have been? Would it have been before the...
Well, by a big cat, and that was 68. Mm-hmm. I think the third one was there.
Okay.
I'm not really sure of the dates. The second one was Judith Bennett. Then Virginia Chafin. Mm-hmm. I replaced Lorraine Rossi. Joyce Eastlick replaced me. Mm-hmm. And I've got a gap.
Okay.
And the early ones, there were two. One who was advisor to the director, and one who was advisor to the training center commander. And so there were usually two of us there,
okay,
plus an NCO
at
the training center.
Were there two American women assigned there when you were there then, as well as an NCO?
I don't remember.
Okay. You went out there in January.
Yes.
1970.
There were a lot of American women in Vietnam.
Yes.
But we were there were a few assigned to Headquarters MacVie.
Mm-hmm.
One colonel, one lieutenant colonel during my time there.
Do you remember who they were?
Alice Long was one of them.
Uh-huh. She was at MacVie?
Huh?
She was at MacVie?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Elizabeth Branch.
And any idea what were they doing?
Alice was the administrative assistant in the office of the J-1.
Mm-hmm.
And Beta Branch, after she finally got there, her background was in operations. But she wound up being the chief of history for MacVie.
I thought that name sounded a little familiar to me.
She lives in Washington now. Alice Long died several years ago.
Okay. But Betty Branch is still with us.
Yeah, she's on the foundation board.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Small core.
It is, and your recall of who was where and when is terrific. I mean, this is exactly the kind of stuff that's so helpful in mapping out the situation that you entered in January.
Kathleen Wilkes died several years ago, but her sergeant is still alive. Her name was Betty Adams, and she lives here.
Oh yes, and. I've had a little bit of correspondence with Betty.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Your trip over to Vietnam, do you remember it?
Do I ever? I left around midnight, I guess. It was dark when I left Atlanta. And I went to California.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat next to two flight nurses who went to sleep every time the plane took off. Had no one to talk to. It was going out in this unknown, found out how big the Pacific is and how long it takes to get across
it. For sure, yeah.
And I got there, and it was January in Georgia when I left, and it's not bad cold, but at least it's cool. And my predecessor, Lorraine Rossi, and one of the men, small world, the man who met me was a colonel who was a husband of the woman who had been the secretary in the white director's office.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes.
Well, that's interesting.
And so they met me at Consonute, muggy, miserable, and it looked like the grimmest, darkest place I had been. I wasn't afraid. That wasn't it, but it just was uninviting. And when I left, I realized it was so much brighter. Well, it wasn't. I was just used to
just
it.
Just used to it. That's it. That's interesting.
But we went to the BOQ, and I said, oh, well, I can go to sleep. I had not really been very familiar with jet lag, and I wasn't accustomed to having helicopters flying over all the time. And my eventually, my room, which was the room assigned to the advisor to the women, had been a closet. It had room for me and a single bed, a chair, a little desk, and a cabinet, a closet-type thing, and had a bathroom, and it was fine.
Now, this was your office at...
That was my bedroom.
Oh, that was your bedroom. Okay.
My office was within the Vietnamese complex in the same building as the director. And then my American office was in MACV headquarters.
Okay. And how much time did you spend between, can you give the distribution of between the two? How did you spend your time? Mostly at MACV or?
I spent all the mornings with Vietnamese, and if I traveled with them, you know, it was a whole day thing or some such. But there wasn't that much to do for me. Most of it had already been done. They had gotten all the equipment, and if they needed something, they needed a Jeep one time. That's a good example. They had to go to a board made up of Americans and Vietnamese and justify it. So that was interesting, helping them do that. But part of the time, we didn't have an administrative officer in MACV headquarters. That was before Alice Long got there. And I filled in doing that in the afternoon for a while.
Let me ask a little bit about the Vietnamese Women's Armed Forces Corps itself. Can you sketch out what kind of an entity we're talking about in terms of size and structure and mission?
I don't know how many there were. They were all in one corps, but they had a group with the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy who had their own structure. I think one of the worst things we did for the Vietnamese was saddle them with our personnel system.
Really? Why do you say that?
Well, because it was inefficient. Because a mechanic is a mechanic in many ways. If you can do it in the Army, they were not interchangeable because their MOSs were strictly service-related, and a lot of things were common. And they had their personnel system was just like ours, their personnel management system, their MOS system. It was just carbon copy of ours. They had a personnel manual that didn't have an index in it, and I set about one day to index that thing, cross-reference index it. And that's when I realized how inefficient it was.
Because you were really getting to grips with this, with the structure and sort of seeing it.
Well, if you cross-index something, you learn a lot about it.
You get the idea. You get it deep.
A mechanic, an automobile mechanic is an automobile mechanic. The ones in the Army could do Air Force automobiles just as well as anybody else, and they could have been interchangeable. But, no, they had to have our system. I don't know. It was minor point, but I just thought it was inefficient.
Yeah, so the segmentation.
We always do it better.
Uh-huh.
You know, we know how to do it.
So you were saying that within the Corps, they had units assigned to each of the service branches of the South Vietnamese Army.
Well, no, they had people in the Army.
I'm sorry, yes. Right.
I mean, with the Army and with the Air Force. And they had parachute riggers. And they used a lot of clerical-type things. They all had gorgeous handwriting. And so I can't remember their using computers, but I'm certain they did. You know, data input,
mm-hmm.
things like that.
And can you hazard a guess at the strength, the woman power strength, if you will, of the Corps?
No. If I probably knew, but it's long gone.
Oh, okay. Who were the people that you were working directly with? Do you remember their names and their ranks?
Yes. The first director was a lieutenant colonel who was later promoted to colonel.
Mm-hmm.
And name was Hung, H-O-A-N-G. I can't remember what. The Vietnamese last name is the family name, and Hung was truly her first name, but she was Colonel Hung.
Okay.
And the deputy was a lieutenant colonel named Hang, H-A-N-G.
Mm-hmm. Did you develop a relationship with either of them or both of them? I mean, a kind of beyond your professional interactions?
It was hard to do in some ways,
mm-hmm.
because they couldn't socialize. They couldn't afford to socialize.
What do you mean by that, Ann?
Money.
Okay.
Colonel Hung invited me to dinner at her home one time, and I met her parents. Her father had been a government official, and she told me that in the early days of the war, when the advisors first came in, they did a lot together, but the cost of rice and those types of things just made it impossible. And I tried several times to get her to come have dinner with me at our officers' club, and she kept turning me down. But one night she agreed to come, and she came, and we had dinner. And we traveled together occasionally, and
mm-hmm.
then, you know, we would always eat together. She liked things American. She spoke beautiful English, Chinese, and French.
No kidding. Hmm.
And I was invited to things with them. One night, there was a big party that one of the Vietnamese generals was putting on at one of the hotels. It was a very nice party.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't find out until later that he got credit for the party. My counterpart had to pay a lot for that party, probably more than a month's salary. And I just thought it was so unfair.
Now, how did that, what was behind that? Why was that the case?
I don't remember what the party was, but uh-huh. there were a lot of Americans there.
Okay.
And she was just...
By virtue of her position having to...
Yeah. She was there, so I was there.
Mm-hmm.
It was... It was just, she had to help pay for it.
And would you say that her salary was probably substantially less than her equal in rank, who was a man within the South Vietnamese?
Well, the man was a general.
Oh, okay.
And
uh-huh.
I imagine they did not want for money. I don't know that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you suspect.
And I suspect that he could have had entertainment funds. And it was well after the fact that I realized what had happened. But I enjoyed being with them.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned meeting Lieutenant Colonel Huang's family.
Yeah.
Can you describe the house or anything about that evening? Who was there?
She was a widow. At least there wasn't a husband, and she had at least one son. Mm-hmm. And my Lorraine Rossi got to know them a lot better because I'm not quite sure. There was more socialization, I think.
Mm-hmm.
All I remember is a very pleasant evening and the best crab asparagus soup you could possibly ever want.
Hmm. That sounds gorgeous.
And you know, rice and meat and just wow. Pleasant. Her parents didn't speak English,
mm-hmm.
but you know, she interpreted for me.
Let me ask about the.
And I was pretty good with chopsticks too.
You were pretty mean with the chopsticks.
Yeah, before I went to Vietnam, I mentioned I was going, and a waiter in a Chinese restaurant in Kansas City taught me how to use chopsticks.
There you go. That was good.
Now that I have arthritis, I cannot use them at all.
Oh, that's sad. But you were in your day, you were pretty mean with those.
Oh yeah, one day I was eating in a Vietnamese mess hall, and this young man sitting across the hall from me, he never stopped eating and he never took his eyes off me.
No kidding.
Just shoveled it in.
Well, did Lieutenant Colonel Huang or her, and the women who were serving under her, did they appear in uniform
all
the time?
They had a uniform, mm-hmm. and they always looked neat and clean. Now, they might have on flip-flops
mm-hmm.
with their uniform. And I saw Colonel Huang in stockings one time, and that's, you know, and there was a little building next to our office that was their barracks. And the way they lived, I don't know how they looked so neat and clean all the time.
Now, was that because the barracks were in pretty bad shape?
It was just a little building.
Mm-hmm.
And the most they had for looking at themselves was a hand mirror.
Wow.
And I got the notion that they needed a full-length mirror.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to one of the Americans, he was in supply, and asked her if she could get me a mirror. And it was a standard door size mirror.
Yes.
And I took it in one day, and Colonel Huang was away at Staff College then, and I gave it to Colonel Huang. And well, it was on in my office. I said, I have something for you. And she came in, and oh, she was just so excited. And it stayed in my office for a month. And I thought, what's she going to do with it? Well, she did something that I would never have thought of doing. She cut it in half and put half in the barracks and half in the office.
Smart girl.
Yeah.
She's a smart cookie.
And then one that they had what looked like an old towel as a, you know, to clean the feet.
Yes.
At the front of the office. So I went and got a raffia doormat. Oh, well, I conned somebody out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I took it in and just put it in front of the door one day. And Colonel Huang came out and she said, oh, I have dreamed of having one of these.
No kidding.
And you realize how little things matter.
And in this context, how they made such a big difference.
Yes.
That's very telling. And what... let me just clarify where their offices were located.
On the Vietnamese compound adjacent to Tan Sanut Air Force Base.
Okay. And what was... You've mentioned the two lieutenant colonels. How much did they have in the way of staff personnel there at that location?
I don't remember. They had a driver.
Oh, yes.
And a car.
They
no,
did.
A Jeep. They had a Jeep.
Uh-huh.
And they had clerks in the office, but I don't remember how many.
Okay. And was this a kind of a bustling office? Was there a sense of things being done and attended to, or was it more laid back and less pressure? And
it did not seem to be very pressureful. This is an interesting story to me. Well, all my stories are interesting.
I know they are. You're right.
But just before I left, Colonel Hung wanted to a new Jeep, and she had to go before a committee of Americans and Vietnamese to justify the Jeep. And I had been to too many briefings with the Vietnamese where they sat and stood and read every word on the charts in Vietnamese, and it was just deadly. So I talked to her about it. I said, don't read it to them. Let them read it. You don't need to read it. She said, well, how will I know when they finished? I said, they'll stop looking at the chart and look at you. She did. It did. It worked.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so surprised that, you know, sure enough, they quit looking at that and looked at her, and she went on. And somebody told me later, that's the best briefing I ever heard a Vietnamese give.
I mean, it's very diagnostic of the atmosphere there.
Yeah.
Did things change at all for you in terms of the workload or the kinds of activities that either the Armed Forces Corps or you were involved in when the U.S. and South Vietnamese troops entered Cambodia in May 1970?
I wasn't aware of it. I was aware of the restrictions were being placed on going there because I wanted to go in the area they called Parrot's Beak to visit someone, and I had to get special permission from my general to go.
Now, who was your general?
Oh, shoot. I can't remember his name. This is the general who was the J-1.
Oh, okay.
I've lost his name right now.
And you wanted to go up to the Parrot's Beak. For what purpose?
A birthday party.
And whose party was it going to? Was it?
It was a Lieutenant Colonel Patton, the guy I had known in the Pentagon, and his troops called me and said, "We're having a surprise birthday party for the Colonel. If we come get you, will you come?" I had been there once before. He had invited me to a party to christen their new swimming pool.
Uh-huh.
Over Valentine's Day. And so the men knew me, and they knew that we were friends. That's all, we were friends.
Right, and they wanted you to come to the party.
Yes.
And did it work out?
Sure.
So you got permission?
Yeah.
Okay. The
first time I went up, he had them put an extra bed in his hooch in a little room, and he made sure that I knew that I locked the door.
Oh boy, yeah.
When we went to bed, and for the second occasion, he said, "I knew something was happening because they put another bed, cot, bed."
He had a suspicion something was happening, but
something
he couldn't
was happening.
Now you said his name was Lieutenant Colonel Patton.
Yeah. Not kin to the general,
but spelled the same way.
Yeah.
Okay, and. That must have been, I mean, did you know him very well then?
Well, we worked across the hall from each other in the Pentagon for all the time, probably all the time I was there. So it was a Pentagon hall. I had a window, and they used to come to my office to look out the window to see if it was raining.
Okay. And so from that little acorn, great things grew, including your trip to the Parrot's Beak. Now, what was he doing up there? What was
commanding a helicopter?
Oh, okay, a helicopter unit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, this second trip that you made up there was around the time of the incursion or afterwards?
It was while we were there.
In?
It was during, because
okay.
there were restrictions on going there.
Mm-hmm. You've alluded a couple of times to different trips that you've made around Vietnam. Were there others that you remember that you could tell us about, and what the purposes of them were, and where you went?
I went most of the time with Colonel Hoon. She would be going to visit a unit somewhere, and I would go with her. I had there's a beautiful beach that I went. Went in that area one time, and she arranged for me to have a flight around a Buddha that was very well known, and I flew with a Vietnamese Air Force pilot in a little plane. Delightful trip, taking pictures all the time, and there wasn't any film in my camera.
Oh no!
But I can't, for the life of me. Bung Tao,
oh, mm-hmm.
I think, is where it was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I realized probably how gorgeous Vietnam is from the air. The shoreline just looks like someone took a piece of chalk and drew it down.
Mm.
And everything's green and lush and pretty.
Where else might you have gone on in these inspection trips or visits around?
I didn't keep a diary. I should have, but I didn't.
Well, you've got it all in your head.
But I don't.
You've got quite a bit of it. Did you ever get up into, say, the Central Highlands? For example, Dalat or Pleiku, Khon Tum? Anywhere?
I did, but I don't remember.
Okay. What about further north or to main American bases like Cameron Bay?
Oh, yeah, I was in Cameron Bay.
Uh-huh.
I had friends who were there.
You, I'm sorry, what?
I had friends who were
stationed
there.
Right. And so you probably went up to visit them at some point.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I was there at some point.
Well, did you ever go further south down into the Deep Delta?
I don't. Recall.
Mm-hmm. What was an average day like? A day that you weren't traveling? You said you spent part of the time, part of the afternoons over at the MACV complex.
I'd get up, have some coffee,
mm-hmm.
drive my buddies over to MACV. I had a car.
Okay.
My job had a car.
Uh-huh.
And I had four men who rode with me every day. And I'd put them off, and then I would go over to the Vietnamese compound and do make work frequently because she didn't need me. Truly, they had already built up everything they needed, and they had everything going. And to me, it was a be-there job, oftentimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I, in the afternoon, usually would go with MacV. And I had to check my mail, see what sort of porn I'd gotten from Denmark.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And when you're in Vietnam, you want any piece of mail you can possibly get.
Right.
Just something to open.
Just anything.
Yeah.
Would you say that the position was one that didn't necessarily need to exist? Was it more pro forma?
I think so. In the later days.
Uh-huh.
I'm certain when it first started, it really needed to exist. If they were going to establish something, because they had to establish a training center, a structure, and WAC detachments all over the place.
Uh-huh.
So.
And you mentioned the equipment issues, but most of that had already been had been resolved. Were you thinking much about the progress of the war. Did you ever feel insecure when you were, you know, driving back and forth around Tanzania?
No.
No mortar attacks? No.
The closest thing I came to anything unpleasant was I was in downtown Saigon one time, and a grenade went off by the USO. Now, that's, and I don't know why it did. We had a curfew. We had to be in at 10 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
unless we had special permission to be out. And oftentimes, if we'd go into Saigon to have dinner, then we would go up to one of the hotels and sit on the roof and have a cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just unreal to be doing that in such a really civilized way, watching mortar rounds going off in the horizon.
And do you have a distinct memory of that?
Sure. I also have a memory of the roach that walked across my coffee cup.
And was this a monster-sized roach?
Pretty good size.
Pretty good. I'm thinking it might have been.
the most monstrous one I ever saw. My bathroom had a john and a lavatory and a shower with a curtain mm-hmm. over it mm-hmm. and a curtain rod. And one day I was taking a shower, and all of a sudden the largest roach in creation landed on my bony chest. He had come off the shower rod. That's the biggest one I ever saw.
And that was way too close.
I also had a gecko in my room, and that was good because they mm-hmm. mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm. Yep, geckos are friendly and good to have around.
One day I opened the cabinet, and the gecko fell off and landed on me. And I don't know who was more surprised, he or I. I didn't mind him, though.
But did you have a sense of being in a war zone? It almost sounds surreal, sitting at the top, you know, on the outside cafe area of a hotel and, watching a war.
Yeah, the surrealism about it, because the way life went on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we had to, we worked until X o'clock, whatever it was, I don't remember,
mm-hmm.
whether there was work or not. You know, work expands to fill the time available, and that was certainly true in Vietnam. But we couldn't have a shorter day because the people in the field were working.
So you would keep on?
Yeah, you'd mm-hmm. be there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of the people, one of my good friends worked in the assignment business there, and he had to go in every night to call Washington because of the time differences.
Oh, sure. Uh-huh.
But you go to town and go to Saigon, and here is this bustling city. Walk down the street. I had a picture taken in front of one of the buildings that a lot of newscasts were made from. I think it was the old opera house. And I deliberately had a picture taken there so I'd know I'd been there.
Really?
Because it was an unreal time to me.
You know, that grenade going off that you mentioned, that didn't rattle you? Or bring it, you know, kind of bring the conflicts, you know, pretty close to you?
I thought about it, but then one time I was on a ferry. I don't know where I was going, but I was on a ferry.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this body floating by, and all the people, VC, VC. I don't know whether it's VC or not, but.
Hmm. Was there sort of jubilation?
Yeah, they were real.
We got them?
Yeah, got one.
Got one. Wow. That's very strange.
One of my memorable experiences was walking down the street one day in Saigon in my little Green Cord uniform. Here came two young men, obviously having a good time in from the field after being thirsty,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
walking toward me, and I wondered, what is going to happen? Well, they saluted, and the senior one says, Good afternoon, cutie, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. What did you make
it made my day.
I was going to say. That's interesting. In general, did you find that the American men over there were willing to accept that you were a lieutenant colonel? And
sure.
And any incidents that seemed to undermine your authority as a as a senior officer? I mean, you're a senior officer at this point.
No.
Nothing like that?
Uh-uh.
That's remarkable.
There were two young men who were MPs, a young black man and a young white man, and they were out on the street all the time,
mm-hmm.
and I frequently passed them, and we had this, I never talked to them, but we had this thing. We'd give each other a peace sign as I went past.
How did that start?
I don't know. I started it probably one day.
Well, that's interesting, and it leads me to ask about your sort of broader sense of the American investment in Vietnam. Did you, and of course you're keenly aware that, you know, in the States the upset, the temperature is rising in the opposition to American involvement. What did you feel in your own mind, not as an officer, but in your own mind? What were you thinking about this whole epic in which you had this little role?
I'm trying to remember what I thought.
Did you think we should get the hell out of there?
I didn't think we were accomplishing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I thought we were putting too good a face on what we were doing. And hearing the people, I never went to the 5 o'clock follies, but hearing the stories of the 5 o'clock follies and the body count. I guess the body count was the thing that got to me the most, because it just was. I can't describe it. I'm sorry. I'm not emotional. I just can't find a word.
That's okay. I mean, it was certainly a frustrating situation for many, many Americans, both those who were in Asia and those who were in America, to get to grips with.
When I came home, I didn't have any sense of resentment toward me. But most people don't expect a woman to have been there.
That's right.
But I went out to lunch one day in Atlanta, and it was in January. And as the waiter looked at me and he said, "You have a beautiful tan. Have you been to the beach?" I said, "No, Vietnam."
What was his response?
Nothing.
Hmm.
I did have a beautiful tan.
He was absolutely right.
Yeah.
Were you aware of, or did you see evidence of others who, having served in Vietnam, were kind of taking
it on the chin
at all?
No, I didn't see it, because I came from Vietnam and went to an assignment at Redstone Arsenal. And the military is pretty well accepted in Alabama.
That's right, yeah. It's not uphill there.
I lived in an apartment complex that nobody paid me any attention. As far as my being different, I put on my little green suit and went to work every day.
And this was beginning in early 1971.
Yeah.
And what was your job there?
I was the secretary of the Missile and Munitions Center and School. Are you familiar with the secretary of a school?
No, that's what I wanted to ask you about.
It's the administrative officer.
Okay, so the chief administrative officer? Essentially?
I was in charge of personnel, civilian personnel, security, the library.
Mm-hmm.
See if there's anything else. All schools have one, and they just the administrative person.
Was this a good posting for you?
It was, until we got a new commander who did not like me.
Now, when did that happen?
That happened probably, I stayed there till 1973, so it probably happened in 1972. The commandant retired,
uh-huh.
And we got a new commandant, and he just... He was the only person I ever worked for that I neither liked nor respected.
How did you guys get off to a bad foot? Had you known him before?
Never.
How did it, what started it going south?
I was at one of the other, my other little jobs was running, overseeing the bookstore.
Uh-huh.
Almost every school has a bookstore.
Okay.
And he had, and there limits on what you can sell in a bookstore, things related to the training mission,
sure,
of the school.
Sure.
And he got this notion that he was going to run it as a small business, and I guess use his idea of how you ought to run a small business, and he was doing things that were crooked.
Oops.
He was stocking things that should not be in there. And the young lieutenant who was running it technically answered to me, but this man was,
mm-hmm,
they finally closed it. Had a closeout sale and closed it. And he didn't like my bucking him. He didn't like me.
And it sounds as if this was less about you than about anybody in that position, the position you held, who was doing their job.
Yeah, I think so. He went so far as to ask the IG to find something bad about me. The IG told me.
Really?
Later.
And
I asked him one day, the colonel, if I could talk to him, and he told me, no, I don't have time to talk to you. And you don't do that to your staff members. I was one of his immediate staff.
You reported directly to him?
Yes.
Was this a... do you think there was some gender issue going on here, or was this guy wired for conflict?
I don't know. I don't know how I got crossways of it. The assistant commandant, for the whole time I was there, he and I locked horns one time over something,
mm-hmm,
and I said, I went in and I said, I have three things I would like to say to you.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I want to do a good job here. I can't do it without your support. And if I was wrong, I apologize. And we never had another moment's problem.
That was a very reasonable set of things to say, and I'm sure that you were, just having spoken to you, and I'm sure you were equally reasonable with the other fellow, just something.
Well, it was obvious I didn't like him, finally.
Mm. And clearly, he was...
I called my career manager, and I said, I am not doing myself any good here. I am not doing women in the Army any good here. Please get me out.
And how long did it take before you got a response?
Very quickly.
Really?
She had talked to me before and asked if I might be interested in going to Leavenworth to teach because they finally were willing to have a woman instructor. And I didn't hear any more about it. And when I called her, I said, is that still a possibility? And that's where I went.
This was in 1973.
Yeah.
Were you the first or among the first women instructors?
I was the first after World War II.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Ann, let's take a break right there. Now, tell me about that. This is Thanksgiving Day, what, 1970?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And they were having a service, and it was a Christian chapel. I didn't understand a word that was said.
and they were having a Christian Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Which is obviously an American holiday.
And also interesting to go occasionally to a Buddhist temple.
And you did that too?
Yeah. And then there's a strange little religious sect called the Khao Dai.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mixture of Buddhist, Roman Catholic, who knows what else. And I went to their temple one time.
You know, Winston Churchill was here yesterday and commenting that his grandfather, the prime minister, was one of their patron saints, one of the patron saints of the Khao Dai sect.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, he thought absolutely hilarious, because it's just his grandpa, or as he called him, grandpapa. Did you go out to Tainin and to their big temple out there?
Yeah.
What was that like?
Fascinating.
I'll bet it was.
And there was a monk who took me around, spoke very good English.
Really?
One of their emblems, as I recall it, was just a huge globe. And I don't think it was a globe of the world. I think it was a globe of the globe. And, you know, I took off my little shoes and trooped around in there. and their theology seemed to be just such a combination of stuff.
Something from everywhere.
And then one time I went out on a little platform out in the water to see this wizened old man who was some sort of oracle, not understanding a word that was going on, but being duly respectful.
Absolutely.
I went with my counterpart.
And what did she make of it? Did she have any commentary?
No, she wanted to go herself, and took me. I don't know what she made of it.
But you trooped along.
Oh, sure. Never miss an opportunity.
Well, absolutely.